Thank you all.
Next up is Smessler. This is Smessler.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Paul Lindenmuth here on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if possible, for rebuttal.
Sure.
The appellants in this case are two brothers. When they were both toddlers, one of the brothers, the younger, Derek, was ran down by a Bronco automobile, which had a lift kit on it, which was driven by defendant Paul. The older brother, Dylan, observed the accident and, as a result, brought a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress due to a PTSD diagnosis relating back to that event. After the lawsuit was filed, we reviewed the affirmative defenses brought by the defendant in the case, and one of the affirmative defenses they raised was comparative fault, as well as an empty chair defense, naming the father, Ron Smeltzer, as a potential empty chair who could be subject to allocation of fault under 422.070. So we moved pretrial for summary judgment. We were successful on summary judgment on the fact that the children, who were under the age of 6 at the time of the event, could not be comparatively or contributorily at fault as a matter of law. On the issue of whether or not the father could be an empty chair or someone potentially allocated responsibility in the verdict form, the trial court ruled that even though he would be subject to parental immunity, because the word immunity is set forth within RCW 422.070, that he still could be allocated fault under the terms of that statute. We argued at that time and continue to argue that the term immunity as used in that statute is ambiguous because we know there are so many different varieties of immunity that it'd be hard to encapsulate it into one word. We have sovereign immunity, we have tribal immunity, we have judicial immunity, legislative immunity, qualified immunity, discretionary immunity.
Doesn't it include all immunity except under Title 51?
It states that, but the term immunity in and of itself is ambiguous, and particularly when it comes to applying it to parental immunity. Because we, in Washington, in Zelmer, the Supreme Court left open the question as to what is parental immunity. If you read Zelmer, they posit the idea that it could be either a privilege, an immunity, or simply an acknowledgement that there is no actionable duty against a parent for negligent supervision. That concept also applies to contribution claims, as we know, and any other claim by any third party or a defendant trying to bring the parent in and saying that they were negligent in the supervision of their children. So the question then is being begged, is parental immunity an immunity?
What if it's not?
If it's not, then if there's no cause of action against a parent that is cognizable under the law, then there can be no fault under that statutory scheme. Because RCW 422.015 defines fault as being something that is negligent. Well, to be negligent, well, at a minimum negligent, if to be negligent, you have to have breached a duty. Otherwise, there's no negligence. That's the first element, breach, proximate cause, and damages. If you don't have a breach, you have no fault. So if you can't have fault under that statute, you don't fall within the definition of fault, then you can't be allocated fault under RCW 422.070 because you've done no actionable wrong. And the case
so
law
what
that we've...
extinguishes a duty of a parent toward the child, if not the immunity?
What distinguishes it is the fact that, as a matter of policy, there's been a recognition that we are simply not going to impose a duty onto a parent to be non-negligent in the day-to-day supervision of their children.
Except for willful, wanton misconduct?
Well, there are other exceptions as well.
Which would say that they're culpable or capable of being allocated fault.
They are exceptions to the rule that are very fact-specific. And if you look at them, I think there's one, I think it's the Merrick case that said they have to be looked at a case-by-case basis. The most recent one, there was an exception made for operating a boat in the Wood case, Wood versus H.O. Sport. There's also an exception for operating an automobile, or when the parent is actually operating in the course of their business. But that's not the facts here. What we're talking about is a case where the children were playing it. They live on a very large piece of property. It's a wide open piece of property. Defendant Paul, who had a dating relationship with the father at the time, is leaving the property after visiting one afternoon. The children are playing in this field, which is wide open. There's no obstruction. She should have been able to see these kids at any point in time she wanted to look. The allegation would be is that he should have been watching his kids, and he should have been more vigilant. But that's hardcore a failure of supervision. In other words, not minding the kids or not keeping them under surveillance. That's by definition. I think that, and if you look at the Holodock, I think it's the Holodock versus Spencer case, which is cited in Zalmer, which is a New York case, which really recognizes that parental immunity really means no cause of action. And I found another case at Idaho last night that says the same thing, and that's Pedigo, P-E-D-I-G-O, versus Raleigh, R-O-W-L-E-Y, 610 P-2nd, 560, and that's an Idaho Supreme Court case.
So are you saying it's an open question in Washington whether a duty exists for parental supervision of the children?
There's certainly, yes. I have to admit that it has not been resolved. It's been touched upon. If you look at the Tellericchio case, which is one of the contribution cases, there's two back-to-back cases, and I think 105 Washington 2nd. One's the Bond case, and one's the Tellericchio case. In Tellericchio, they talk about it. They use the terms that, and I quoted it in my brief, basically saying that there is no duty in Washington, or there's no duty for a parent to be non-negligent in the supervision of their children. That's not the quote, but it states that. There's no analysis there, though, so whether or not I can hang my hat on that standing alone, I suspect you need to do a deeper analysis and actually have to do a policy analysis and look at the various approaches from the other states. Because they do touch on it in Zalmer, but they raise the question, but they don't give us the answer. But the problem is that if you're going to then use parental immunity as a fault allocation issue or make them an entity who can be allocated fault under 070, then we have to answer that question. Because we have to know whether or not they can be subject to fault at all under Section 015. If they don't fall within the definition of fault, if it really means no actionable duty, then they cannot be put on the verdict form. We were forced to put them on the verdict form amend our complaint and add them in as a party based on that ruling. Then he defaulted. He defaulted and did not file an answer. Our position as well is that, well, if he had parental immunity, at that point, once we're in that posture, when we never should have been in that posture to begin with, once he's defaulted and has not asserted a parental immunity as an affirmative defense, he's waived it. And the defendants in this case have no right, the other defendant, has no right to raise parental immunity given that waiver. The comment to the restatement indicates that this is a personal defense. It only applies to the parent. And that concept's consistent with the idea that you can't bring in the parent through the back door for contribution by a defendant that gets a judgment against them. So there's a lot of interesting issues in this case regarding parental immunity. And then ultimately, we had to bring them in to preserve joint and several liability because we have fault-free children. They can't be allocated any fault, so you still have joint and several. Then we get the verdict, and we don't get joint and several. There's other issues. I'll reserve my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Joanne Henry, attorney for the respondent. I agree with Mr. Lindenmuth. There are some interesting issues in this case, and it's a bit complicated, but clearly there was no error. RCW 4.22.070 is absolutely the centerpiece of the 1986 Tort Reform Act. It requires allocation of fault to all entities that cause plaintiff's damages, even if the plaintiff can't recover against them, and it must equal 100%. It sets the several or proportionate liability as the norm, changes joint and several liability severely limited. It expresses the basic policy of tort reform that each at-fault defendant only pay its share, and that even fault-free plaintiffs can't recover from immune defendants. It simply cannot be harmonized with prior common law. Because the allocation scheme is statutory, purely statutory, the out-of-state cases and the restatement are not helpful. Regarding how that fault allocation gets into the case, the cases point out that Section 070 is not self-executing. Either the plaintiff or the defendant has to identify the potentially at-fault entities, whether they're parties or not. Then someone has to prove fault. The plaintiff proves it if he wants to recover from them. The defendant proves it if she wants to have her share of the fault reduced. Here, Ms. Paul appropriately identified Ron Smelzer as a potentially at-fault party or entity and requested allocation of fault. The plaintiffs were the one that raised Mr. Smelzer's parental immunity at summary judgment because they wanted to argue that because he was immune, he couldn't be allocated fault.
How about his argument that, you know, parental immunity really isn't an immunity at all in Washington?
That's not what Zelmer holds. Zelmer holds, and actually I think that Mr. Lindenruth is simply confusing the concepts of negligence, which is simply the duty to exercise ordinary care, with the elements needed to prove liability for negligence, which is duty, breach, proximate cause, and damages. The rule of Hume versus Fritz Companies is directly on point here, that the defendant in the case is entitled to raise the immunity of a non-party, or in this case, a party. But plaintiffs here are trying to argue that parental immunity is somehow different. Any immunity simply means that the party has no actionable duty of care, that they cannot be held liable for their negligence. Zelmer did not say that a parent cannot be negligent, that cannot fail to exercise ordinary care in supervising his child. Zelmer says that for policy reasons, the parent is excused from the consequences of his negligence. That's the essence of any immunity. The immune entity commits no actionable wrong. He cannot be held liable for his wrongdoing. That doesn't mean he hasn't engaged in wrongdoing. The jury found he did. Plaintiff's exact argument here that was addressed in Humes. They argued that the Indian tribe's immunity meant that they had no duty to exercise ordinary care and so therefore couldn't be at fault. The court discussed that and rejected it. The holding of Price versus Kitsap County from the Supreme Court is every juridical being, and I've never heard that one before or since, capable of conforming itself to a standard of care is potentially in the fault allocation mix. And that definitely has to include immune parents. And I think as one of you pointed out, the statute specifically carves out in 1991 industrial insurance immunity because the legislature decided for its own policy reasons to take that out of the mix. And believe me, it's difficult to try a case with industrial insurance immunity when those people aren't in the mix, because where does their negligence go? But that was something that the legislature decided. If the legislature had decided that allowing children to recover against their immune parents was more important than the basic policies of tort reform, they would have written that in too, either in the original statute in 1991 or at some time later. We agree with Mr. Lindenruth that since parental immunity is like any other immunity, although they don't say that, we agree it can be waived. It seems to be the rule, although it wasn't discussed in the Romero versus Spokane School District case, that if an immune entity truly does waive his, her, its immunity, then a plaintiff can seek to take judgment against him by making a claim against him and proving his fault. However, as in this case, a plaintiff may very well have a tactical reason for not making a claim against a potentially liable party. In Melu, and I've always wondered how that was actually pronounced, for instance, the claimant simply didn't believe that the first driver in the chain collision was at fault, so he only claimed against the following drivers. In Adcox versus Children's Hospital, and I noticed that wasn't cited in either of our briefs, that's 123 Washington 2nd 15, the hospital's theory of the case was that no one was at fault, so they didn't attempt to prove fault on the part of the plaintiff's doctors. Then after they got tagged for 100% of the damages, on appeal they came in and said, no, wait a minute, we wanted to allege fault on the part of the doctors. And the court said, no, you've got to do that affirmatively, and you've got to prove it. Here, and it's an interesting question, whether or not Mr. Smelzer effectively waived his immunity by defaulting to the amended complaint, which we contend didn't even plead a cause of action against him. so that his sons could have asked the jury for a judgment against him. They expressly elected not to do so. Whether that was a relationship thing, they didn't want to blame their father, whether they wanted to protect him from a contribution claim by Ms. Paul, or whether it was simply trial strategy, the plaintiff's theory of the case was that Ron Smelzer was not negligent at all and that 100% of the fault was on Jeannie Paul. The big part of their strategy was to paint her as grossly negligent, make her as unsympathetic a person as possible, that she was often drunk, and they were even suggested on the basis of no evidence that she was impaired at the time of the accident. When it came time to instruct the jury, they dropped their argument that their father had waived his immunity. We specifically asked on the record, and I included that as an appendix to our brief, are you making a claim against him or not? And the answer was no, we are not contending he's negligent. On that basis, we proposed the instruction the court accepted and plaintiffs accepted was courts number 12, which did not instruct the jury that plaintiffs were making a claim against their father and that they were asking only for a verdict against Paul. In closing argument, they argued repeatedly that Ron was not negligent and 100% of the fault was on Jeannie Paul. That's embedded in their closing argument PowerPoint at Clerk's Papers 1616 to 1617. Answer yes to Jeannie, no to Ron. Answer 100% to Jeannie, zero to Ron. Had that strategy succeeded and the jury accepted their argument, Derek, who was the prevailing plaintiff, could have recovered 100% of his damages from Ms. Paul, which would have been essentially, you know, the same as a joint and several verdict. However, just as Mr. Mayu guessed wrong in not claiming against the leading driver, and he lost the 10% of his damages that were allocated to that driver, and in Adcox, the hospital guessed wrong, ended up with 100% of the damages instead of splitting them with the potentially at-fault doctors. Plaintiffs here guessed wrong. The jury decided that Ron was at fault, said 50% to Jeannie Paul, 50% to Ron Smelzer. By not making a claim against their father, they were put themselves in a position where they couldn't take a judgment against him. And that's the rule of Mayu. And that's not limited to insurance cases. The court was specifically saying, we're explaining the basic operation of Section 070. No one can be liable to the plaintiff unless the plaintiff makes a claim against him. Unless the plaintiff makes a claim against him, you can't take a judgment. No judgment against two or more defendants. There's no joint and several liability. That is simply how tort reform is designed to work. If that's not fair, if it doesn't have good results in cases, if the plaintiffs don't like it, you can talk to the legislature. The courts have to apply the statute as written.
Would it have made any difference if he'd made a claim? It seems to me both sides agreed there wasn't willful, wanton misconduct, so the only claim was negligence.
Well, I think that
he would have been immune from liability
well,
on the reading of the statute.
Okay. Mr. Smelzer testified at trial, and no one asked him about his immunity. He didn't waive it. He didn't assert it. He did, in fact, default to the amended complaint. So plaintiffs had the argument, which they dropped immediately before instructions, that he had waived his immunities, and they could claim against him. That was the point where I'm standing up there arguing instructions. I said, wait a minute. Are you claiming against him or not? Do we put the instruction in that says plaintiffs claim that these two defendants are negligent and allocate fault, they have the burden of proof, or are you really saying that just one defendant is negligent and you're leaving it to us as the affirmative defense? And they said, yes, we are not making a claim against Dad. One final thing, and it is, of course, in the brief, is that if the court does find any of this allocation issue to be error, the sole remedy would be simply to amend the judgment and assign Mr. Smelzer's 50% share of the fault for Derek's damages. There's no ground for any sort of a new trial. Thank you.
Of course, I think it's the Mullinex case. I don't know how to pronounce it either. It's readily distinguishable because the other party was never named or brought into the lawsuit, and we, in fact, did bring Mr. Smelzer into the lawsuit. He was named on the verdict form. He was allocated fault, and damages were awarded. And those damages were awarded to Derek or to the Smelzer child. We also have an issue regarding a poison pill instruction here, the unavoidable accident instruction that never should have been given in this case. And that was harmful because it interjected a defense that should not have been in this case at all, particularly how it affected the child's case that got a zero verdict. You know, the jury will very...
Why does it matter in the context of the jury finding negligence?
Because they found no negligence with respect to one of the plaintiffs on his PTSD claim, the negligent infliction of emotional distress claim. And we don't know what kind of confusion and havoc that instruction creates. That's why it's a disfavored instruction. They could have decided that, well, once the accident happened, it was unavoidable that somebody was going to see it. We don't know what they do when they're back in that room, and it wouldn't hear in the verdict anyway. The whole idea that there can be, our argument is there can be liability without fault. Fault is defined for the purposes of 070 as under in 015. Fault includes acts or omission, including use of product, that are in any measure negligent. You must establish negligence before you can have fault. We don't have liability in the air in this state. You have to do something wrong. And if there's no, if you don't breach a duty, you didn't do anything wrong. And that's the end of the story. You never should, and we need this answered, is what does that word immunity mean when it comes to parental immunity? And it has to be defined as there is no actionable duty. You have no duty to watch your kids 24/7. You have to have some discretion. And that's the whole purpose behind parental immunity. Thank you so much.